Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But, you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. KSJE is supported by San Juan Regional Medical Center, here to meet your urgent and emergent medical needs, whether they are COVID-19 related or not. Medical emergencies happen when you least expect them. Whether it's a stroke, heart attack, illness, or injury, San Juan Regional Medical Center's caregivers are here to provide care to you and your loved ones. Find out more online at sanjuanregional.com. Minutes past 8 o'clock. It is Thursday morning, January the 7th, 2021. Good morning, everyone. I'm Scott Micklin. Thanks for tuning in to KSJE 90.9 FM over the air here in San Juan County, New Mexico, 103.3 FM in the Durango, Colorado area, and streaming everywhere from our website, ksje.com. Welcome also to our viewers who are watching this visual radio program this morning. It is streaming live to the KSJE Facebook page and our Twitter account. We're glad that you are with us, everyone. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Coming up in the next few moments, my guest on the program today, archaeologist Paul Reed from Archaeology Southwest, is going to be joining me. We're going to be talking a lot about how DNA is being used up to a point in some of the work of Paul Reed and his colleagues, and much, much more. Also a little bit more about the adaptability of human beings across our world. That is coming up in the next few moments, so we're glad that you're with us for that. Then, of course, it is the return of our COVID-19 local community information program this morning, streaming live at 9 a.m. on YouTube and Facebook. Our guest this morning from San Juan Regional Medical Center, Dr. Robert Underwood, also from the San Juan County Office of Emergency Management, Mike Mestis, will be joining us with details about the current conditions, of course, at our hospital, the continued availability of testing for COVID-19, and the rollout of the COVID-19 vaccines in San Juan County. So we'll be talking all about that and much more coming up today. Again, a live stream at 9, a rebroadcast on the radio at 5:06 this afternoon, and of course you can also hear the rebroadcast on our partner radio station, KNMI Vertical Radio. That's at 88.9 FM. On the radio side of things at 9, Mick Hess is going to take us roving with the arts after the news at 9:06 a.m. This morning, Mick is playing music from Stravinsky on the program, so you can certainly tune in for that. Don't forget, of course, in addition to Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, we invite you to connect with us on Instagram as well. And let's talk about the weather forecast for just a moment. Outside right now, it is partly sunny, 23 degrees in Farmington at the moment here at KSJE. And our forecast calls for a partly sunny day today with a high of 44. Overnight low tonight with clear skies, 17. Partly cloudy again tomorrow with a high of 42 on Friday, 39 and partly sunny on Saturday. Sunshine returns on Sunday with a high of 38 and an overnight low of 14. Sunny and 37 on Monday. Back into the mid-40s, though, by the middle of next week, and maybe even some upper 40-degree temperatures by the end of next week. So let me turn to my guest, who is with me this morning from his home in the Taos area. Archaeologist Paul Reed is joining me once again this morning. Paul, good morning. Good to see you. Happy New Year.
Good morning, Scott. Happy 2021 to you.
Thank you very much. I think I saw a social media post this morning that said I want to return this year after the 7-day initial period because I don't like it. But I don't think we can do that. So we're committed, aren't we?
No, I think we're in.
Yeah.
Got to go forward.
I think so. But we are resilient, and as we're going to talk this morning, human beings are adaptable too. So that can maybe serve us well in these past few months that we've lived through and the upcoming ones that we're about to. So that's kind of our focus today, right?
Right. Right. I mean, you know, we've talked about, I don't know, sort of dipped our toe, I guess, might be one way to put it, into what DNA and our genetics tell us about things at various points on the show. I just finished a very interesting book on this, and so I'll just plug that. We don't normally do this, but it's by a guy named Adam Rutherford, and it's A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, which, you know, is I think an admittedly optimistic and grandiose title.
Right.
But, you know, this man is a geneticist. He came up as a biologist, as a PhD scientist studying the human eye from a genetic standpoint. And then he got very interested in science journalism and broadcasting. So he has some really cool videos, too, that folks could search out. He's from Great Britain. But anyway, he wrote this book, I think, to sort of help people understand a little more about the genetics of humans and really in some ways to do some myth busting. And sort of the biggest one that I think he tries to, you know, poke some holes in this giant balloon that we have about genetics is that everything's tied to our genetics. This explains everything. You know, and some of his examples are people who do really heinous crimes in the world that, you know, scientists have studied different things and looked for those bad genes, you know, kind of rendered most simply.
Right.
And he basically says, nah, that's not how it works. You know, we have our genetic background, you know, our mom and our dad for each of us gives us half, you know. We get 23 chromosomes from each with about 20,000 genes total. They all get mixed up, and then we are who we are. We're this tall, our eyes are this color, you know, all these different things. But it's the interaction of our genes with our environment and even with other humans in a social environment that's most critical. So anyway, I've found this really fascinating and sort of helpful for me as I look at some of the things that, you know, I'm trying to understand just in, you know, the archaeological realm.
Right, right. Well, it sounds like kind of almost maybe a word of caution for folks in your line of work, right, that there is only so much maybe you can glean from using some of this new technology in your line of work. And as you've mentioned, we've talked before about how useful DNA technology has been in kind of maybe answering some of the questions, but I guess it's a kind of cautionary tale, right? You can't depend too much on this or you could go down the wrong rabbit hole, I suppose.
Right, right. It's, you know, and I think we've mentioned this before on the show. If we're talking about the archaeology of whatever, you know, area on Earth, the DNA, the genetics work is important, but then we also have to have, you know, archaeological work. What have these folks live? What sites were they like? And we put those together, we really have a more comprehensive understanding of it. So part of what I was thinking about this morning and kind of the run up to coming on the air with you was, you know, I think as humans in part, and maybe Americans are special in this regard, it's hard to know, of course, right? Because I'm totally stuck in my own culture. But it seems like we're always looking for that one answer, right?
Sure.
You know, our proverbial smoking gun. Here's what it is. This is going to explain everything, at least maybe in this little micro area of research or something that we're interested in.
Right. The missing link, Paul Reed. The missing link is what we're looking for.
Exactly. And I think, you know, this writer, Adam Rutherford, is really good at saying, you know, that's a false hope. You know, we're not going to be able, we can decode our own genetics. We can find out through 23andMe or these other services, Ancestry, you know, MyHeritage, who we're related to and who we might be related to worldwide. And I've done some of that work for my own family. And it's really interesting. But it's not going to tell me if I'm going to die next week, you know, that's a little morbid, or in 10 years or whatever,
right,
from this specific disease. And he raises the point really specifically about one disease called cystic fibrosis, which, you know, was one of the first ones way back in the 90s, I believe, that they decoded genetically. And it's, you know, if you get this gene from your mom and this one from your dad, you're more than likely to get the disease, you know. So people obviously look at that, and if you're someone who has that condition, that seems like sort of a genetic lock and not a very optimistic prognosis for you. But the point he was making within that is there is, you know, there's the gene that carries that specific disease, but there's 5 to 10 others that influence how severe the version of the disease that you might get is going to be. And that's where he says, look, you know, there's the simple, you're likely to get the disease, more than likely, but here's the expression through your unique genetic combination. So basically, again, the cautionary tale. We can identify certain things, but the complexity starts after that point. And we really need to do a lot more work. You know, plus he talks about how genes interact with the environment and some of the changes that actually happen in our genetic code and then can be passed on to, you know, our children and the next generation. You know, and this kind of contrasts, I think, with what people might understand, you know, from an evolutionary standpoint as sort of strict Darwinianism, which is you have your genetic code, natural selection operates on that. And of course, one of Darwin's contemporaries was a guy named Lamarck, who talked about, you know, potentially passing on traits. So if you had, you know, a man who was a blacksmith and had a big arm and he worked all the time, he got giant biceps, that would automatically be passed on to offspring. So we know that that's not how genetics works, but there are subtle changes in genes and in the expression of genes that can get passed on to offspring. So anyway, you know, the more I learn about this, it's just more and more interesting to me. So
I would think so. And again, as it goes back to the work that you've done, and we'll bring it back maybe locally too, to some of maybe the discoveries at Chaco Canyon or Aztec or Salmon, where you've done a lot of work, you know, that has the study of DNA evidence has helped to open up and answer some of the questions that we've had about those folks who lived in these areas, correct? I mean, it has been useful.
Right, right. You know, one of the things that helps understand as we're looking at different populations is basically having as much of genetic material from as broad a group of people as possible. So this is why sort of modern DNA sampling is successful. You know, if you want to discover who your closest genetic ancestors are, you submit samples to your company, and then they compare you to the millions of people and, you know, the DNA that's been decoded worldwide. So that helps. When we're talking about much, much smaller population sizes and sample sizes for DNA, it does complicate it, as we've mentioned in prior shows. So if you have a dozen individuals, you're going to have a certain amount of variation in those dozen individuals. If you go to 24 or 100, then some of those patterns that you're going to see will shift a little. It doesn't mean that the genome or the genetic code of any of the individuals changes. It's the comparisons that can evolve through time. And that's basically because of the statistical techniques they use. They fall mostly under the category of discriminant analysis, which means you compare this to this, and you say these are closely related. Well, you add a third group, and all of a sudden you've shifted the relationships between the first two, right? And then if you add five more, you build different relationships. So, and that's a fairly simplistic, you know, presentation of that. But basically, the more data that you have in this particular, you know, field, the better your results are ultimately going to be. You know, and of course, this is kind of the old mantra, too, that we have talked about for scientists anywhere. We generally need more, better, and higher quality data to understand things.
True.
And we need good hypotheses and theories and things to then apply those data to try and sort out, you know, what we think is happening.
Right. And I guess as the work continues on some of this DNA data that's being collected, do you feel that maybe there'll be more that we'll learn about some of the work that you've already done with some of these samples from some of these places in our area and around the world as we learn more about how to interpret maybe some of this DNA data or maybe even other stuff in the DNA that we don't quite kind of can read just yet?
Yeah, I think that definitely will be happening. One of the interesting things that this author, Adam Rutherford, talks about is, you know, the big human genome project, which was, there's two that he talks about, one that was privately funded and one that was funded with public sort of, you know, U.S. government grants, national science and the like. These both happened in the 90s. And, you know, there was a big announcement in 1999 and 2000 that they had finally, quote, decoded the human genome. You know, that we have as humans roughly 3 billion individual letters, you know, in the sequence that makes up our DNA. You know, and of course, this is generally in the form of the double helix that Watson and Crick decoded back in the 50s. You know, so, I mean, the story of genetics is really a good example of how science works over many decades. But the specific point that Rutherford was making in this context is, you know, we've decoded the human genome and we're all excited about that and it's great, but there is so much in there that the geneticists still don't understand. And, you know, he wrote this book in 2018, so we're a couple of years after that. His basic point is the research continues, there's more we need to learn. And one of the more interesting things about our genome and really the genome of, you know, every living thing on the planet is there's a whole lot of just accumulated material that's in there. You know, these sequences of the four letters, strands of DNA, just random proteins. And if you introduce a new strand or a new sequence of these letters, it can totally change what, you know, this particular run of, say, 500 letters is supposed to do in your body genetically. And that's pretty much how we understand mutation today at a genetic level. Something happens to change that particular line of code, and then all of a sudden there's a different expression. You know, maybe that code's eye color or something, you know, something, some piece of some other expression that comes out in the person, you know, when they're actually born. But the point is, you know, are these huge strands, this long 3 billion sequence of letters, it holds a whole lot of baggage from our evolutionary past. And part of what is challenging for the geneticists and the scientists trying to understand this is figuring out which, you know, sequence of those 50 letters or 500 or 2,000 is really important for the traits that they're trying to study. So this is also part of the, I think his, you know, I think very well written, but also sort of the cautionary tale is, you know, scientists have been able to map onto different portions of that string of 3 billion letters that each of us has. But by no means do we understand each one of those letters or each one of those sequences, you know, so that's an ongoing process that is really, you know, years and decades in the future. And, you know, I'm real optimistic that we will understand more of it. This author, though, specifically says that, you know, even if we get to the end of this or closer to the end in 20 years or whatever, we're still not going to be able to say, hey, here's your specific genome. We know exactly what's going to happen in your life from this point forward, right? So basically, I think we could paraphrase some of what he's saying by saying DNA is not destiny, essentially. And you as an individual person, us as individual people, we still have to interact in our environments and how our specific genetic expression interacts with environmental variables, social variables. You know, that's where it gets real interesting and complicated. And that's where we really can't model a lot of that.
Right, right. Very interesting. My guest this morning, archaeologist Paul Reed, he is with Archaeology Southwest. He joins me once a month to talk about the work that he is doing and other things that are going on in the world of archaeology. And Paul, I want to shift gears just a little bit on the second half of our segment together this morning, continuing to talk a little bit about DNA, but also about human beings and just how adaptable they are in different climates. And this is something, again, that your work shows, I think, quite clearly. And when we were talking about this as a topic for today, I began to even think about just living here in the Northwest Plateau of New Mexico and just how extreme our climate can be. If I didn't have, you know, a house with heat and cooling and things like that, it's a pretty extreme place 12 months of the year when you go from maybe 100 degrees to 10. And if you don't have sufficient shelter, that could be very very difficult. I know climate changes and evolves and devolves and all those things, but that's had to be very difficult for folks who called this place home over time.
That's right. And that's what, you know, of course, when we're talking about people, humans and our adaptation, that's what makes it really interesting because, you know, for the rest of the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, all other life on Earth, their adaptations come from their genetic code and then certain behaviors that are encoded in that. For humans, we've used culture and technology, you know, with capital letters, capital T, capital C,
right,
to augment our genetic code and our physical attributes. And of course, this is why, you know, different renderings in the past, we've been described as, quote, naked apes, because, you know, we've lost a lot of the characteristics that our primate cousins have, and certainly in the remote past, the ancestors to both of these lines, humans and the other primates, we've lost a lot of those physical characteristics that allow, again, our cousin primates to survive in different habitats around the world. And we've replaced them. You know, we were wearing clothes, you know, where our hands evolved over millions of years to be highly dexterous and allow us to adapt and to really manipulate a broad variety of objects, and that technology starts, you know, with stone tools and evolves to very complicated electronics as we're using today. Yeah. So that makes it particularly interesting, but, you know, we still have all the underlying genetic components to that. So that makes for a very interesting study as those things get layered in on top of each other. And of course, we can't pass on technological skill, you know, or learn things through our DNA, because again, that's not how it works. But certain things can get encoded in our DNA through time and help us adapt. And, you know, and we see this in the modern era so much, but in, you know, one of the articles they sent you was a high adaptation, high elevation adaptations of people. And we do find that folks in Tibet and other high elevation areas in Peru, other places around the world, actually do have genetic enhancements, shall we say, for living at higher elevation and being able to extract enough oxygen living, say, above 12,000 or 14,000 or 15,000 feet. You know, so that's a very interesting intersection. They also have, of course, all the human technological and cultural adaptations. So I think this really illustrates well, at least in my mind, you know, the complicated interplay and intersection between human culture, technology, and the genetics, and sort of what that allows us to do. You know, and that's one reason why when we talk about different species around the world, we describe the parameters. You know, these species generally live at this elevation or in this range with this kind of, you know, generalized climate. You know, vegetation, these are the plant life, the plant forms, the other animals. Well, humans, of course, we filled every niche on the planet to ones that are very inhospitable.
Right.
And we've done this through our unique genetic code and through these cultural and technological adaptations. So, you know, again, I think that's, of course, for me, this is partly why I enjoy studying, you know, us humans, because, you know, we're incredibly adaptable, and there's so many different ways to address these different problems that human societies and groups encounter through time. And DNA is an important part of this, but it's not going to tell us everything. So again, that's kind of a cheer, I guess, a cheerleading cry for let's have the geneticist weigh in, let's have other people who study different parts as well. And I think if we look at the way archaeology works and the way science probably should work in general, we want a very multidisciplinary approach is the way we describe it. We want people with different levels of expertise in different fields, and we put those together, and then hopefully we end up with a better understanding, a better narrative, and again, ultimately be able to tell a better, more accurate story about whatever it is, you know, we're wanting to learn about and understand.
Exactly. And from your research, Paul Reed, has there been any DNA or other evidence that you've noticed from the ancestral Puebloans who lived in our area of how they adapted to their climate, or some of the artifacts maybe that have been found in some of these places? Because I would imagine that the climate was as extreme as it is even today, maybe a bit different, a bit wetter back then when the area was populated. What have you learned? What can you share?
Well, I mean, specifically in the realm of the DNA work, not very much at all. You know, this is something that if we're going to go down that path and understand that, if we want to study a particular group's ancestry, then we need to collaborate and, you know, have a real full discussion with the groups who might want to be part of that study. You know, and then I think we've mentioned in the past, Scott, we've had, you know, different studies in the past where people have had their medical information used without consent, and, you know, really that there's been a lot of issues with that.
You bet.
So I think in archaeology at this point, if we were going to do that kind of work, we would want to work with the descendant communities and say, hey, here's something we'd like to study, you know, and see if that would go and how that might work out. You know, but I think on the other side of it, there's a lot of concern by different indigenous populations, not just in America, but worldwide, at being, you know, the objects of scientific study, and, you know, with a lot of the abuses that have happened in the past with colonialism and other things. So, you know, so this is not something that I would personally do without, you know, a very specific set of, you know, procedures to go through and with full involvement from those indigenous descendant communities and really asking what questions, what interests those groups might have as we start to look at different research issues from the past. So, yeah, so a lot of this work hasn't been done, and, you know, it's hard to say if where this might go in the future. But I think that if it would proceed, at least we would do it in a different climate and with full consent, you know, a knowledge of all the parties participating, sure. You know, in contrast to some of the abuses of the past.
Well, and that was going to be my next point, is that that hasn't always been the case, as history will teach us. And so this is kind of right. A new way of looking at things in your industry and a lot of others that are maybe a bit more enlightened, for lack of a better term.
Well, right. You know, and there's way too many examples of people, you know, going in for certain medical procedures and having other medical procedures happen, having their information used without consent. And, you know, so I think we're trying to correct some of those mistakes from the past, but there is there's a lot of bad things that happen and a lot of baggage. So, you know, I think that we've really got to be super aware of those as we move forward and really just think of different ways to involve groups if we want to study specifically about this part of this group's history or something else, and really just work a lot harder. And, you know, I think that a lot of my colleagues in anthropology and archaeology have really front-loaded these issues, and these are things that they're thinking about very actively. And, you know, so again, I think we're heading to a better place. But, you know, well, as we do that, we need to be aware of this history and, you know, just have that be very a key part of our understanding.
Sure. And so if we go back to maybe the non-DNA evidence that can teach us how our neighbors lived back in the day, and I mean, they were very aware of their climate and very aware of the location of the sun and the moon, and we know they use that to measure the seasons and time, correct me if I'm wrong, but the buildings that are left behind kind of teach us a little bit about, you know, some of the ways that they adapted to our climate, correct? Just the way that Chaco Canyon, I'm thinking Pueblo Bonito, is designed, and even Aztec, they had some of these things in mind for their architects, did they not?
Right, absolutely. You know, I'm of course live up here in the area around Taos, and you know, Taos has become sort of the epicenter of this notion of solar building, right? With the guy named Michael Reynolds who developed these earthships where you use modern cast-off garbage, you pound tires and build really thick walls, and you face your buildings to the south. Well, that is certainly not Michael Reynolds' invention, you know, whatever innovations he's brought to it, and I think there have been some. You know, the Pueblo people from the past and other indigenous groups worldwide are the original solar builders in our world. You know, if you look at Chaco, all of the great houses, or, you know, 95% of them are sited on the north side of the canyon facing south. And this is designed to capture the solar heat primarily in the summertime, or I'm sorry, in the wintertime, and to be able to live in a multi-story dwelling that has, you know, not too many other external sources of heat. So, yeah, I mean, there's so much that we can learn from looking at the way folks have interacted with their environments and, you know, worked out these different issues. And the solar building really is the key to it. You know, the house that I live in now north of Taos is faced to the south. We have active solar panels that bring in some electricity, but we also just have a whole lot of passive solar gain, which sure. Means that the way it's built, the windows are set up. So with the low winter sun, that sun comes in. In fact, you can see a nice little,
there it is.
the sun's coming in on me now. And so, you know, this upper room that we have here is basically a solar room, and it heats up. Even if the outside temperature is 20 degrees, this room will heat up close to 80 degrees on a winter's day.
Nice.
You know? So, yeah, I mean, the solar gain really does work. And these are principles that, you know, the Pueblo people in Chaco and many other places worldwide worked out a long time ago. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of knowledge out there waiting for us to you know, sort of tap into it.
True.
We just need to be sure that we understand, you know, how it was developed, and then, you know, give credit to the people who did that.
Indeed.
And we know if we had little innovations, that's great too. But you know, Taos may be sort of the solar capital of today, but it's not the solar capital of forever.
Right. True.
But all time.
Right. But we certainly know that, you know, the fire, use of fire was certainly a big deal for folks to maybe light and heat those spaces, right? In addition to some of the solar things that they were understanding. Do we know anything more about how they maybe kept cool in the summers in that canyon? Because I would imagine that would be, it's pretty hot if you go down to Chaco Canyon in July, even today. I would think it was probably similar back when it was populated, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, right. The nice thing about building really thick walls, you know, in different environments is, you know, we tend to think, I think, first of the solar gain and the heat. So if you have a massive wall and you're getting winter sun coming in on that stone wall, and floors do this as well, if they're in sunlight, they'll absorb all that heat and then basically generate it, put it back out into a room, into a series of rooms, even after the sun's gone down. The other thing that happens in the warmer months of the year is those walls act basically as insulation. So even if the walls heat up, the way the buildings are built, the summer sun is, you know, quite a bit higher. So you're not getting the same heating. So you're essentially shading those areas, and those thick walls will keep in sort of the cool temperatures that we fortunately have really in the high deserts of the Southwest overnight. So those temperatures will pretty much be conserved. Certainly the rooms will heat up some. The other thing that they did, of course, is they built, you know, different ventilation windows into rooms that lined up. So if you had any breeze coming through, you could open your doorway flaps and move your doors out of the way. And of course, one of the fascinations with Chaco and Aztec and other places is that the doors are lined up. Well, you know, that's might be partially a visually sort of aesthetic thing, but it also allows really good airflow through these, you know, very large Pueblo buildings. So you've got air flowing through the doorways, and you've also got it flowing through vent windows, which also line up with each other, you know, throughout the building. So there were different ways that they were able to cool the buildings. You know, I don't think there's any doubt that on certain summer days, you know, over 100, 105 degrees, that, you know, there was some of the rooms were pretty hot.
Right.
But, you know, any of us who have basements, of course, know as well that in the summertime, the coolest place is in the lowest part of the house. So, you know, it's cool and cold in the winter, and it's cool and cooler anyway in the summer. You know, so essentially you go down to cool off and you go warm to heat up. So, you know, there were different ways of doing that for sure.
Interesting. Well, fascinating. Again, as usual, Paul Reed, fascinating discussion this morning. I appreciate your time and your insights very, very much. Thank you.
Well, Scott, thanks for having me.
You're
very enjoyable.
You're very welcome. And we will connect again in about a month, if that's all right.
Sounds great.
All right. Thank you so much. That is Paul Reed from Archaeology Southwest, my guest here on KSJE. And I'll be back with more in just a moment, everybody. The time right now is 8:41. KSJE is supported by the University of Denver Graduate School of Social Work, Four Corners Program. The program is accepting applications for the Advanced Standing MSW program starting this summer 2021. Students with a bachelor's degree in social work are eligible for the one-year program. Complete an application by January 15, 2021, and the application fee is waived. Stipends in child welfare and opioid workforce expansion and Native American tuition support to eligible students are available. Find out more from Janelle.Doughty, D-O-U-G-H-T-Y, at du.edu or at du.edu/social work.